Yeah, well, I will say last week I had to re-record the intro, and the second I hit the record button, they start drilling in the apartment above me, like no joke, like full on, full scale, like burr. I was like, can you give me 10 minutes? This is Brooklyn. Everyone's recording a podcast. Hello and welcome to Securities, a podcast and newsletter devoted to science, technology, finance, and the human condition. I'm your host, Danny Crichton. Today, we have two special guests, our own scientist in residence at Lux Capital, Sam Arsman. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
And author and writer Elliot Pepper, whose novels include Reaper, Veil, the Analog series, the Cap Table series, the original
Uncommon
trilogy.
Stock. Oh, Deep Cut.
Common Stock
yeah,
trilogy.
Deep Cut.
Elliot, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Fun to be here.
So all three of us happen to have read the same novel, Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin, which is a story about basically two video game designers who met in, I believe, middle school, high school, continue their relationship at Harvard, MIT through college, and then start a game studio. So we're seeing this sort of creative collaboration over two decades. And I found it to be a really, really special book because we don't often see creative collaborations kind of get fictionalized with all the kind of drama and interpersonal dynamics that actually come out in building work. I was curious your first impressions reading this sort of science fiction novel.
For me, one of the things that I love most about this book is how compelling it is. And I wasn't expecting that to be the case. When I read it, every chapter, I wanted to immediately start the next one. And that's that kind of page turner back cover blurb that you'd normally see in a book is usually reserved for airport thrillers or mysteries or that kind of thing, where they're using really tight plotting to create that sense of you, the reader, wanting to know what happens next. In this novel, it doesn't have that. There aren't assassinations or, you know, like mystery boxes or like the explicit external plot elements that you would normally associate with a page turner. But every single section makes you want to find out what happens next. And the reason why I thought that was particularly interesting with a novel about game designers is that so much of making a great game is thinking about stakes, right? Like thinking about what are the chips on the table when you're playing poker? Like, what does the player care about? What do they want? What is the ring you're, you know, seeking at the end of your quest or what have you? And how do you really make that feel real, make that feel compelling and invite the player in? And I thought that Gabrielle really does that so effectively for readers. And so it made me start to think about the parallels between novels as a form and games as a form, especially because, you know, a book about it, when you write a novel about making games, in some ways, you're also writing a novel about making writing a novel, right? It's like very self-reflective. And so that was one thing that immediately stuck out to me. I couldn't figure out why I wanted to keep reading so badly. And that was just fascinating and made me want to keep reading more.
Yeah, and I really enjoy it. And I have to admit, the reason I was pointed to it was actually Elliot, his recommendation. And it totally lived up to the recommendation. So that was amazing. For me, there's kind of the craft of the book itself. But for me, also like a lot of the different themes just I found really interesting. Like, obviously, there's the theme of collaboration, but there's also the theme of creation, which in this case is like building virtual worlds. I love this idea of like, how do we build rich, well-developed worlds with their own rules and everything like that? And that's essentially what games are. And they kind of showed this very messy human real process of building virtual worlds. And I just found that fascinating. There's also a lot there in terms of how people think about meaning and purpose. And because obviously the two main characters, they are just like bound up in this. And like the creative act is like so much of what they're obsessed with. But his viewpoint is much more around there doesn't need to be these like titanic cosmic acts of creation. You can kind of just have a much more humble meaning of like helping catalyze or assist other people's acts of creation. And I found that really powerful as well. So yeah, so I think, yeah, there's so much there about like meaning, purpose, creation, collaboration. Yeah, it was great. And just kind of kept me reading as well.
You saw this kind of intelligent range between, you know, the work that is really great, that is for the artists, that's for the other game designers, you're trying to impress people, you're pushing the craft forward, but then it's a commercial flop, right? That no one really enjoyed it. It doesn't really work. So you did this amazing art, but no one appreciates it. And then in reverse, we saw examples where you have this immense commercial success, but as an artist, you're sort of left unfulfilled because you didn't sort of get what you wanted out of it. And I thought that was a very good depiction, because I think so often in a lot of fictionalized media around the creative process, you're sort of, you know, it's this plot of like reaching to the zenith and you're getting to the point where you have this big success after years of being ignored. And the reality is that most careers kind of go up and down. Like you have a good piece, you miss one, it's too technical or something, it gets out of whack, it goes back up again. And so there's this connection of like, you know, you just never know if this next one, obviously you're always excited about the next thing, but it doesn't always hit as well as you would hope.
You know, taking that a step further, one thing I loved about the structure of this novel is that it sort of subverts what the structure is, even of other stories that are told about creation. Like if you were telling the story of the construction of the Golden Gate Bridge, even the way I just framed it, I just framed the whole narrative, right? It would be like you'd start with the person who had the idea and was like planning it out or whatever, and then like you'd follow how it got built. And then you'd like the finale would probably be like the first person crossing the bridge or, you know, something like that. And so the narrative structure is about the thing that was made. That defines the arc. And one of the beautiful things about this novel is that it goes really deep on the creative act. These two designers, they make multiple games over the course of this story. And so you get to see that making things is an infinite game. You don't just make something and you're done. Like you make something in service of the next thing you make together or the next thing you make separately or what have you. And being able to see the arc of these characters' lives over the course of making and putting out games in different ways and like making different mistakes with each one, like I think is really powerful and unusual in stories about creativity.
You know, both of you, we're all creators here, but in my world, I tend to be on this like, journalism, quick news. I'm on a repetitive cycle like a rat in prison in which every week comes another deadline and has to get done. Both of you actually get to enjoy longer term projects. Sam, you're working on a new book. Elliot, you're revising a new novel. So you've worked on these sort of multi-year projects to get a creative work out into the world. I'm curious, like, how did you emotionally connect with that? Because that was something that like, you know, this idea of planning and then having all this drama, like, yeah, you got drama for maybe 30 minutes in the newsroom and then a decision gets made, something gets published and it's out and you move on to the next thing. How did you feel? Did it connect with you in that way? Was it authentic to your own experience?
I can't speak to the collaborative stuff as much. I'm certainly working with like editors and other people like that. So there is a lot of collaborative, but it's not necessarily a co-authored book in quite the same way. Like I'm like writing these books kind of on my own. That was a little bit different. And I found that really powerful and insightful. But certainly this idea of like kind of being on this long multi-year quest, essentially, where you kind of don't know what the outcome is going to be. Is there going to be this like wild mismatch between the original vision in your head and the thing that actually kind of ends up in the world? There's a lot of that. That really resonated. I think also this kind of like the ups and downs of like, there's like the process of making it kind of independent of the actual thing. There's the process when you're working on it. And then as Elliot was saying, kind of this infinite game of like you make something in order to kind of continue making things. Once the thing that you're making is done, you're often already thinking about the next thing, but then you're kind of required to like step backward and say, okay, now I have to actually publicize and promote the previous thing, even though my headspace is entirely different. I'm now thinking about something completely different.
Even going further on that, I mean, because the two game designers are going to collaborate together, but they don't receive equal credit, both for gender dynamic. One of them is male, one is female. And the male, particularly in the era that the first part of the book is in the 1990s, the media attention goes to him. So there's this tension around who should get credit. Do you go on tour both together? Do you go separately? Because obviously having it separate is a lot more efficient, but then the credit can be very divergent between the two people. And I thought that dynamic was particularly interesting because you're not just in a different headspace. There's also this like, but it's my work. And like, do people actually recognize right. that what I just made, particularly in a team collaboration, is actually mine and it is my idea?
Yeah, I think that's very true. I mean, I've always found that I wish I could learn how to write a novel. But, you know, I'm now revising.
I think you've written, what, 9? You're on 9 or 10, I think, at this point?
11. Yeah.
11.
So I'm currently revising my 11th novel, and I still don't know how to write a damn novel. It, like, it drives me crazy. Like, I'm like, every novel I write, I have to figure out how to write that novel. And
right, yeah, because it's not a unified different. Thing. It's each yeah, one is different in its own way.
Each
yeah.
one is unique. And then inevitably, when I'm writing a novel, I generalize all these lessons learned from it that I will be able to apply to the next project, you know, whether it's something as simple as, you know what, I need to make sure that I think, you know, I know the ending I'm aiming for before I start or something like that, right? Just like take any individual yeah. idea of how you might approach an ambitious, large creative project. And then no matter what happens, the only thing I've found in practice is that any lesson I think I've learned along the way totally shatters at like on the altar of the subsequent novel. What ends up happening is that because they're such long multi-year timelines, inevitably your emotional life is on a much shorter timeline where basically as a writer, you're going on a hero's journey, right? You sort of like you always hit bottom somewhere in the project, right? You always think you've learned something from it, even if it, even if you don't return change. But that aspect that you're actually on a journey that's parallel to the project itself or to the characters in it, I think is quite profound and is very evident in this book. And Sam, I totally agree with you. Whenever I have a book come out, like by the time it's published and you're promoting it and you're talking about it on podcasts like this one, I'm already so emotionally involved in the next project. Like I've been asked questions about characters where I don't remember their name. I spent years working on this book.
So that's an interesting question of like, so there's like the massive ups and downs of the creative process. And like, there's kind of like the initial excitement and the trough of despair, whatever it is, all these different things. Like the way everyone else perceives that creation is like in a much kind of like more concerted kind of burst where it's like, okay, they'll read the novel or they'll read the book or they'll read or they'll play a video game and it's going to be over a relatively short amount of time. How do you make sure that only the best aspects of one's creative emotions are in the actual consumption of those kinds of things?
You only include the good bits. you cut the boring parts, basically. I mean, in some ways, I do think that like art is not life. Art, it includes life, but you're really, it's like a spirit. You're distilling human experience into these like nuggets. And like, that's part of what's so beautiful about it. It's all like, I want to hear what Danny thinks about this because like, sometimes I think that there's an interesting dynamic in the blogosphere where in some ways it's almost like early 20th century literature where you're like, just bring me into your brain and just like tell me everything you're thinking constantly. And that's what the art is, right? It's like I'm putting my psychology on display in a very expansive, loose format, which is beautiful. Like I love reading that stuff and I love writing that stuff sometimes. But I also feel like when I write a novel, it's a very different endeavor where I'm trying to do almost the opposite, where I'm trying to take a lot of things that I've experienced and trying to condense them down into this very distilled piece that can create a powerful human experience that can move the reader. And so you're actually trying to take all of those years of roller coaster and trying to like fit them together and get that, you know, like get them smaller and smaller to where they're this super powerful package where, you know, I don't know, like it's like the first time you eat a xiaolongbao, like a soup dumpling, and you, you know, you put it in your mouth and you don't know what's about to happen and you bite into it and there's this explosion of flavor and, you know, and like that's art in a way, right? You've like condensed so much into this like thing. And so part of the beauty of a novel like Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow is that the author has condensed so much of what life means to her into this thing that we can read in a few hours, right? And that's actually part of the beauty of it.
Well, I think my first experience with a xiaolongbao is biting into it and then immediately having this burst of extremely scalding, boiling hot soup of pork. And that's kind of like art, right? Is you try something new, you eat into it and you're like, my whole mouth is burnt for the next 2 days and I can't taste. No, I agree. I will say, I mean, and Elliot, you and I have talked about this before. I'm a huge fan of what I like to call the lapidary work, but I love these very tight, taut novels that are very aggressive on editing. And I think that comes from being a journalist, right? So you don't have your audience's attention very hard, easily. You have to beat other news that's taking people's attention away. And so Hemingway, Albert Camus, people who were trained as journalists, George Orwell, tend to be my favorite authors because they have to go straight to the point. They have to get there really quickly. It's the telling detail. It's, you know, it's like you can have 30 pages about a tree in the backyard. And it's gorgeous. And it's amazing what the English language can do. But I'm personally never going to write that, right? And so I don't feel the same connection in an art form as something like that.
This reminds me, there's, I think Jerry Seinfeld, when he's like talking about like why he doesn't want to hear other people's dreams. He's like, if I wanted to hear someone else's dreams, like if I wanted another like long, boring story that has no point, I have my life. Like I don't need the story of your dreams.
Well, my version of this is there's no bathrooms on Star Trek. Right? Exactly. I mean, they're telling details that are just missing from the science fiction universe because you don't want to know how all the things work all the time. But Gabrielle has condensed 20 years. I think it's about 20 or so years of creative life into about 400 pages. And I'm curious. So looking at the numbers, okay, it was the top book for Amazon in 2022. They named it their favorite book of the year on Amazon. Paramount bought the rights for several million bucks for the movie. Gabrielle was on Jimmy Fallon and is sort of on the lecture circuit, which I think we all know authors don't get a huge amount of bandwidth from late night comedy. And so pretty prestigious sign-ups if you can get anyone to care about the written word on popular television these days. Why is the book so successful? Like, why does it connect and has connected both with critics and with readers? Because it's kind of an esoteric subject. I mean, I think we've mentioned before, you know, video games in particular as a design topic, not a well-trodden territory. This is sort of, as far as I'm concerned, one of the first books on the fiction side that's really covered video games and video game design. We've seen it with like Blood, Sweat, and Pixels by Jason Schreier over at Bloomberg, who's a video game reporter. So we've seen it on the nonfiction side for sure, but on the fiction side, we've not. Why is it so popular?
It's always a challenge to like have any true explanation of why any piece of art really sort of goes viral, right? I mean, like we can map our theories onto it, but in some ways it's a bit of a Rorschach test. I have my version of it. With the benefit of hindsight, what do I think about this novel helped it accelerate into the culture? Is that a few minutes ago, Sam said that he read this novel because I recommended it in my newsletter. Because this is a book about making things, and because she does such a good job at connecting with how that feels in sort of a novel that is a good story. It's not like a nonfiction book about creativity. It's a good story that you could read just for the story that also happens to have like really thoughtful, in-depth insights into creative process. And who are the people that the most popular novels start with? Usually they start with a small group of fans that really connect with a story and they start telling friends about it. And that's true of any kind of like creative product in our sort of like cultural economy. But I think that it is particularly true of novels because, frankly, there are a lot of them. And the streaming series that will be made of this book, I'm sure, will get a lot of like big budget promotion that even this novel didn't get when it first came out. And so the original readers who connected with it, I think a lot of them felt what Sam described feeling and what, you know, Danny, you and I also experience reading this novel is that we make things like on the internet. And we read this book and we're like, we feel this. We dig that. Like, this is our thing. This is our, yes, this, right? And so that's why we're talking about it this morning. And I think that a lot of other people who basically make things on the internet felt that way and started the conversation about this novel. Those are the right people to have start a conversation if you want it to expand into the larger culture. Because once people who are making a lot of things on the internet start talking about stuff, they're doing it in public. And once you start talking about a novel in public, other people wonder what the fuss is about. And then you get like a major review, right? And those circles start expanding. And then eventually you're on Jimmy Fallon. Like Sam, just so you know, I discovered this novel through the newsletter of a fiction writer I know and love who lives in my neighborhood, Robin Sloan. You know, like it was like Robin read a copy of the book. He makes things on the internet. I, you know, like paid attention to him, and you just see that ripple effect expand out into the culture.
I love that. I'm not sure I have. I certainly don't have a grand theory. I feel like Elliot has captured this much better than I could possibly imagine. The one thing I would just say, I agree, Elliot, video games and video game design, like these are not niche things. Like there's obviously a very large market for it. At the same time, though, the ability to take anything that seems to be a little bit different, but make it compelling, like once it's done well, it doesn't really matter what it is. I mean, like Moby Dick and whaling. Like, I don't think there were that many people interested in the minutia of whaling. I mean, that being said, the book kind of did not do well while he was alive. Separate from that, it had a lot of I guess the idea is if you can take anything, any industry or any kind of act or process and show both the details that make it distinct as well as the things that make it much more universal, it can speak to so many different people. But yes, certainly the idea of speaking to the people doing creating on the internet, that is a super powerful idea. I love that.
Well, I love the idea of just because I start in high school, there's just this creativity and this kind of burgeoning relationship early on of we're kind of nerdy and playing with things when we're young, and then we get into the professional world. And in this case, it's almost like a dream, right? Like for most folks, they are not creating as part of their daily lives. And so what if you kind of just continued? Because I believe there is a little bit of a plot point of do we just go into normal life? There's a discussion about they're at MIT, Harvard. Everyone goes into finance and consulting and business. And in their case, they're just no, we're just going to keep going. And I personally found the book because, Sam, you recommended it in the securities newsletter. And I was I at some point should read one of the recommended books, although we recommend so many books, I'm not sure we can read them all. Yeah. And then, Elliot, you and I had dinner in Chez Panisse, and you and your wife pushed very hard to read it. And the only other thing that has ever been pushed as hard in a dinner in the last couple of years with me was with Josh here at Lux. His wife pushed Ted Lasso very, very aggressively on me, and I never did watch it. So that one did not work because you need, at least for me, I need the double hit, right? The one fan, I'm okay, everyone has their thing. And sure. But if you hear from two or three, I'm the crowd clearly has determined that this book is the one. I want to pivot the conversation to one other topic though, which is this idea of creative collaboration. So we talked a little bit about how we're all individual writers. I have certainly co-authored and co-hosted media over the years, but mostly write by myself, same with you, Sam and Elliot. But the book is a creative duo, or two and a half if you include the business partner. I thought this was a little bit different because when we look at most Western media, we have this sort of narrative structure. You mentioned the hero's journey earlier, Elliot, of the kind of heroic individual, right? This person who fights against the system or fights against science or the frontiers. They have these setbacks. They can't figure out stuff that goes on. And then they eventually kind of come through and out, and they find their discovery and they're heroes and they're lauded for it. I'm even thinking, having obviously not seen the film, but Chris Nolan's Oppenheimer is coming up here about the Manhattan Project. And I'm going to be curious because the Manhattan Project, obviously one of the largest science groups of all time, thousands of people worked on it, but the movie's called Oppenheimer. And I think that it is very encapsulating of the kind of this mentality of even though this is a huge project with some, I think there were more Nobel Prize winners at the Manhattan Project than almost any other single lab in history. But this one person becomes identified with it. Do you think that this is a new trajectory for some media, that we're seeing more of this sort of team oriented narrative fiction?
I think you're absolutely right. There is a very classic story that follows one person as they grow, as they head off into the unknown and try to figure things out and grow. That's popular for a reason. Right. In many areas, life is a single player game, but life is also a multiplayer game. We make friends, marry, we raise families, we do things together all the time. You know, one thing I thought about while reading this novel, because I think it's such a beautiful depiction of creative collaboration, is just what it means to do things together. So what it means to build things together. So take an example, if you've ever gone on a group camping trip, you know how annoying it is. Right. It's you have, first of all, where are you going to go? Right. Is it going to be this national park or that park? Now you have six friends and all of them have different work schedules. How do you even organize when to go? Right. And then, oh, shoot, you forgot that you have to have permits. And we haven't even gotten to are we going to share food? Or are you going to bring your own food? Right. It just keeps going forever. And then you get to the camping trip, and then you have to set up camp and you have to actually do dishes. Right. all of the there's a lot, like it's mostly annoyance.
This podcast is sponsored by Camping Trips USA.
Right. Yeah. I'm not sure that they might revoke their sponsorship after hearing my description of it, but you know. But I think that all of the human banal frustration of like doing something with other people, or when it's late at night on that last night of your camping trip and you're lying and looking up the stars and you have some deep, you know, connection and conversation with the friends like lying there next to you, those are related. Doing hard things together is an amazing way to cultivate human connection. And I think that that is what I found so beautiful about this novel, is that, as we mentioned earlier in this conversation, the arc doesn't follow any of the individual games, the individual creative projects that happen in the story. What it follows is the forging of a friendship through building things together, building things that you love for people you care about. And that is really special and really beautiful. And so I know I'm not answering your question, Danny, because your question was about why is this story form not as popular in, you know, sort of mass media as The Hero's Journey. I don't have a direct answer to that, but I do think that this is a beautiful story form and it's an important story form. And I want to see more of it, right? I want to read more of it.
It's a little bit like a Bildungsroman for creatives, right? Because they're not growing up. They are growing up a little bit in the beginning, but it's mostly backstory, important backstory, but backstory. But it is this like, how do you evolve as an artist? And you know, you're starting from ground zero. You're just learning. You're tinkering, experimenting. You move up. You have mentors. Those mentors are helpful, at times hurtful, and you continue to mature. And I think that kind of natural evolution is probably much more in line with more Western norms anyway in the first place. So it still lines up, even though it's a group. Sort of story.
Well, yeah, but I think that what you just said, that the fact that it's a group, this is actually a Bildungsroman about a creative group. It's sort of like the idea of Sinus, right? Where you have this, like, it's like about this, like the opposite of at least what we assume the Oppenheimer movie will be, right? Like, that things emerge in these unpredictable ways from these special groups of people. And like, in a certain sense, I think that this, it's like a Bildungsroman, but not about a person. It's about a Bildungsroman about 2.5 people, right? And so it's actually about the relationship between, it's the network diagram of those people is the thing that is growing and maturing over the course of the novel, rather than, I mean, they are individually too, but like the real arc is that group.
We can go on tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow forever. This has been super great. Sam Elliott, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.